Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Home-Based Business 101. My name is Isaiah. I have the pleasure of introducing the host. You know him. He's everybody's hero, my best friend. Will you please join me in welcoming my granddaddy, Baba Jahi?
Well, good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. Hey. Thank you so much, best friend Isaiah, as you do each and every morning, introducing the show to our growing and vastly growing listening audience, getting close up to 41,000 now, 40,925 people. I think we'll crack that 41,000 mark before we go into the new year. And again, truly making this listener-supported radio, you know, it's nice when I look back in the stats and see, you know, the number of listeners and then the text messages that we get here at 252-406-0774, those people who are joining our broadcast that we do here on Blog Talk Radio on our platform, Home-Based Business 101. And, you know, hey, zero is no hero. And, I mean, I could look in there and I could say zero people listen. But close to 41,000 people have listened to a program here. Y'all just make me blush all over. It feels really good inside to know that there's a listening base out there that feels that there's some value in the information that we share. As you know, this week we are doing programs around the valued work that, you know, friend, colleague, and comrade in struggle, Brother George Sabir, who transitioned and went home to glory on December 10th, 2010, about a week after doing the broadcast here with me, where we did an extensive broadcast around the questions of economic development. And so what we're doing this week, next week, and week after is reviewing some of his books that he's written. This week we're dealing with Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America. Yes, you can make big money in America without being an entertainer, athlete, or drug dealer. And I just put that out there so that, you know, we can get beyond the stereotypical roles. You know, Hollywood, they portray the image that if you make big money in the black community, you know, you're the monster, you know, you're the criminal, the drug dealer, you know, gangster, and all of this other stuff. It's very interesting. That's a side note, how they make a movie called Gangster, you know, I think that was the title of the movie, but you might know the movie I'm talking about, where Denzel Washington plays in there. What a real gangster. I know. I mean, you know, the real gangsters was Al Capone and Frank Nitti and them cats, you know. But anyway, you know, the thing is that there are people in the African-American community that are doing honorable and dignified things that a lot of times don't get the attention and portrayed the way that they should. And so, you know, we need to make sure that our young people know that there are ways, legitimate ways. And that's what we do also through a program that me and George was working on, and then I finally got it developed and going this year in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, called the Young Adult Business Builders Academy, working with 18 to 25-year-olds and teaching them the world of entrepreneurship. And once they complete the academy, helping them get seed money to go into business ventures as opposed to teaching them how to go get a job being just over broke, you know, the journey of the broke. You know, I don't know too many people with a job that are happy. And you got a few that love their job, but most people's job is just a means to pay bills, and that's why they sing that song, Thank God It's Friday. Even though by Saturday they broke all over again and gave all of their money back to the people that worked them, you know, the whole time around. You know, it's not that much difference today from slavery days. You know, it really is worse. You know, at least the master had a vested interest in keeping you alive so that he could make sure that he could make a profit off you. They, you know, they use you up. But anyway, you know, I don't want to steal all of the thunder from what we want to cover today. And I had promised you yesterday, and my computer froze, that, you know, I was going to play part of the interview that I did with George back in 2010, and so, you know, I do have that up this morning. We're going to listen to a few minutes of that before going into an aspect of the book, and the aspect of the book that we're going to go into this morning, How the Black Folks Guide to Making Big Money in America, is aspect of what is wealth. But before we get into what is wealth, I want to play about 10, 15 minutes of an interview that I did with George back in 2010. So hold on and try to get these volume adjustments, you know, in a good audible format so that you can be able to hear this interview real clearly. And, again, we thank you for your patience, and we thank you also for tuning in to our show. So sit back and let me go bring up the past with Brother George Shabir back from December 2010.
Good take on black economic development.
Well, I have a lot of perspectives, and so I might be sort of long-winded with this, but I want to get...
Go ahead, take your time.
First of all, let's look at Black History Month, and you might say, well, what does Black History Month have to do with any of this? When you look at Black History Month, you ask yourself, who are the people that we constantly parade in front of our young people to say, look, this guy or this lady is a hero, and you should note what they have accomplished, and maybe, if at all possible, you know, think about doing something similar as you go down your road in life. And we bring out, you know, the Jackie Robinson and the Jesse Owens in athletics, and we talk about, you know, George Washington Carver, the scientist, and we talk about all these different kinds of people, including black military people, who some people might say, well, you shouldn't have been in the war anyway because that wasn't our war, and you came back to America and they still treated you like doo-doo, so you were a fool, not a military hero. I mean, I know some people who take that perspective. So they line up all these people that you should salute. Well, if you were to look at that list really clear, you will find that consistently, they never mention black business people as somebody that you should study, admire, except for one person. One person emerges over and over again, and that's Madam C.J. Walker. And the reason I believe that they, number one, heroes, we lead women. So she's pushing two and two. When you want to say, well, we need to have some women in there, so put Madam C.J. Walker in there. And also we know that she was very wealthy. It's been said she was the first black person to have earned $1 million. So she was a millionaire. So the fact that she was a millionaire and the fact that she was a woman makes her an automatic inclusion in that list. But you take her out of the mix and you see black people commemorating or celebrating no black business person whatsoever, which is kind of ridiculous because we've had some significant black business heroes that just aren't mentioned, you know. Even if you look at modern day, you know, when people think of Motown, they think of the music. You know, they think of Smokey Robinson, and they think of Marvin the Vandellas and so forth. They don't really give much credit to Berry Gordy, who had to negotiate the development of a company through a system run by white lawyers and Italian mafia types that changed the world of music all over the world. It has been said, and I can't document it, but if you know anything about Motown, if you look back and say from 1960 to 1980, that 20-year period, it's been said that Berry Gordy has been responsible for the development of 500 black millionaires, that 500 separate and distinct black people had had $1 million pass through their hands as a result of their connection with Motown, whether they be as a singer, as a songwriter, arranger, a lawyer, all the various jobs that people do, they had $1 million pass through their hands. Now, that is an incredible accomplishment, absolutely mind-boggling accomplishment. And you can sit down for the next 5 days and not think of another black person who's ever done anything like that. But is he mentioned as somebody that should, you know, emulate from the standpoint of business, and we should champion that and look at the next person that can develop? I mean, cooperative, is that the people became millionaires. Now, on the other side of the coin, there's people who say, well, get black people out of this money. I mean, Gladys Knight had to file suit, and Mary Wells had to file suit, and the Ozzy Brothers had to file suit. Look at all our suit against Berry Gordy and Motown because they felt they were cheated out of their money. Well, unless you're there and know the specific details, you don't really know who got cheated out of what. We know for sure that white people cheated black people out of money. We know that. But what we don't have is a previous example of a black person building a company and making sure that literally thousands of black people got a shot to do their dream and make money that they could not have made or would not have made had they just tried to latch on with another white company. So what I'm saying is, historically, we have not made any effort to champion the accomplishment of black businessmen. And that's telling the current generation that either, A, we have not achieved enough in that area worth talking about, which is wrong, or that's not an area that we want to focus on, which is also wrong. So that message, you know, whether it be conscious or subconscious or unconscious, I never did get all those words exactly straight. You know, that message is sent. Now, when we look at progress, we always measure progress seemingly as our level of unemployment as compared to white people. So they say, oh, this is 6% unemployment among whites, but it's 12% unemployment among blacks. And from the last 50 years, we've had this comparison of employment, which is a measurement of jobs. And jobs is the foundation. Jobs is extremely important. But why is it that at the same time that we're measuring jobs, we don't measure the growth of business? You know, we should have quarterly or biannually or annually, we should have a measure of the rate at which black businesses are growing. Now, unfortunately, the federal government, they take stock of the development of businesses. But number one, we're dependent on an entity that's outside of our community. We should have, I tell people, black people should at least be experts on themselves, meaning we know more about us than anybody else knows about us. But unfortunately, with all the PhDs and all the statistics out of black people, we depend on white people and white organizations and white surveys to tell us about ourselves, how many of us there are in a particular town, how much we make, what we buy. I mean, we depend on the other people to tell us about ourselves. I mean, that's crazy. When you look at a group that is as educated as we are and so-called determined to be free, we should know, we should have a way of measuring the growth of business or the decline of business and watch it like we're watching a football game. If you were to watch any kind of sport and you didn't know who the players are, and you didn't know how much time was left in the game, and you didn't know what the score was, you'd walk out the stadium because there's no way than hold your interest if you don't know nothing about what's going on. And that's what's happening in the black community. You have a lot of activity going on, but nobody is documenting the successes and the failures, the progress and the retrenchment. And so people just lose interest and not pay attention to any of it. So if we took as much effort in measuring the growth and development of business and saying, okay, through this quarter or through this six-month period or through this year, we had a 0.5% or 1% growth in black business in the state of Pennsylvania, in the state of North Carolina, nationally, whatever the case may be, then it would be a conscious, it would be put into the consciousness of our people, and they would know that that was something that they should pay attention to, because we're constantly looking over the records to see, what's happening in that area. I remember when I first came out with my first book, Black Folks Guide to Making Big Money in America, and naturally I was trying to get as much exposure for the book as I could. And, of course, one of the first places I went was Black Enterprise Magazine. Could you take this book, could you give it a review, and could you, could you kind of get the information out there that this book exists, that they should go to bookstores and ask for it, blah, blah, blah. Now, this was 1980, okay? This was 1980. Black Enterprise came out in 1970. So I hit Black Enterprise 10 years after they were already out there. Okay, they had, 120 issues, 120 different issues had already been printed before I came on the scene. And what I found out in 1980 was that up until that time, you could not walk into any store and buy Black Enterprise magazine. You had to be a subscriber. Why? Because it wasn't available on the newsstand. It wasn't distributed. So even though they had over 100,000 or maybe even 150,000 subscribers to the magazine, the black community, it was felt, was not supportive enough of the business magazine for them to say, okay, we're going to put it on the stand and trust that people will walk up to the stand, see it, recognize it, value it, and buy it. And I was told that I was very lucky that I had caught them at a time where they had just completed their first deal with a national distributor and that they were going to be made available at newsstands nationwide. Now, in that discussion, it came out that they were going to have 20,000 copies on the newsstand, okay? Now, that's a small number. When you consider that in 1980, there were at least maybe 30 million black people as opposed to 40 million that there is today. Out of 30 million black people in America in 1980, certainly 25 million, that they only felt comfortable in putting 20,000 copies of the magazine out. Now, Black Enterprise is the only black business magazine that there is, I mean, as far as a national publication. So, again, that shows a lack of interest on the part of black people in reading about, studying about black business. And when you go to the same newsstand, you'll find that there's three or four different magazines just dealing with black women's hair, okay? That there's four different magazines that you can buy that has nothing but black hairstyles in them. So look at a people where a company is comfortable enough to put four different magazines out there talking just about black women's hairstyles, okay? And yet the only black business publication could not survive on the newsstand for the first 10 years of its existence. Now I'm gonna make one more point and then I'm gonna stop. About 25 years ago, Ebony magazine brought out its 100 most influential blacks. And you went down the line to see, okay, who did Ebony magazine, which has this, you know, this national vision of black people, who do they think are the 100 most important black people in America? And year after year after year after year, Earl Graves was the only significant black business person, other than John Johnson himself, you know, representing Ebony, and also the people at Essence magazine representing Essence. But as far as business information or the business world, Earl Graves was the only business person listed. Okay, you had people who headed up the sororities, the fraternities, you had some union people, you had all different kinds of people, but of the 100 most influential blacks, you had virtually nobody from the business community that Ebony felt was significant enough to say, okay, this is one of our most important people that we need to listen to give our community direction. So, again, when I go back and I say, you know, look at all the other factors that preceded our dealing with the concept of bourgeoisie. Look at the black cultural environment in which business was placed in a very, very small corner of the room. And that's the environment into which the nationalist community had to fit in the concept of bourgeoisie.
Okay. Hey, you know, as part of the interview I did with George Shapiro, I'll play a little bit more of that interview tomorrow. But as he said, you know, for those of us here in the African-American community, is that business is devalued. You know, it's devalued. Some of us like to feel it's getting a little bit more value today. I wonder. Just recently here in Rocky Mountain area and maybe even some other areas, but in Rocky Mountain here, you had last year for Black History Month, I remember this one school was talking to a colleague of mine. He said, you know, the school, they asked the children, you know, to pick a character and deal with, you know, who they wanted to be, da-da-da-dee, and all of that for Black History Month. And you had a couple little children come in, little girls come in. Nicki Minaj! What the heck does Nicki Minaj got to have do with being a historical black figure except for a black buffoon? But the thing was, and again, it's not that I'm here, you know, to bash people or whatever. I'm just saying is that the images that are projected amongst our youth, and as George is saying here, is that the images and what people are what is put up in front of people, you know, the quote unquote role models to choose from, you know, the business, he said, is, you know, is stuck to the other side of the room, stuck in the corner somewhere. You know, everything but what's real. I remember one of my mentors, and I'm going to dive into part of this chapter because we're going to get down in the wind down time in a minute. But I remember one of my mentors, Francis L. Warren, who was the first black regional commissioner of HEW, you know, Health, Education, and Welfare, a child who grew up on welfare to one day manage welfare. And, you know, we used to talk, and, you know, he was mentoring me, and, you know, and he was just sharing one time, and he was just saying that, you know, the problem is that, he says, we give our people limited visions, and he said, because they're so caught up into survival. He said, we're going to survive. That's not the problem. The problem is how do we survive and how do we move beyond survival? You're going to survive. But having a plan for going beyond survival, we just get happy and celebrate. Ah, paid my light bill this weekend. Glory, hallelujah, amen. Go to church, shout, dance, jump, praise. I paid my light bill. Okay, well, come on, what's next? What do we do next? Let's make that, well, that's rudimentary, you know, that that's going to happen anyway. I understand we go through trials and tribulations, and sometimes, you know, some things happen, and you call it a situation where, yeah, it's a struggle to get that done, people, but let's put a game plan together. And that's what George is talking about here in terms of business, putting a game plan together. And that game plan, it deals with, as he talks about in his first chapter, of Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America, is the question is, what is wealth? He said, how can bright, ambitious, energetic, and talented folk build wealth and a comfortable lifestyle for their family if they don't know what wealth is? Is wealth defined by how much money a person makes in a year? Is wealth simply the fact that a person has a very attractive home, car, and wardrobe, otherwise appears to be doing okay? Is wealth having a fat bank account? Do wealthy people put their money in banks? Good question. These are just a few questions that you will have to answer for in order for you to feel comfortable with your definition of wealth. You have to stretch your imagination to better understand the meaning of wealth. And if you can do that, you're at least one step closer to the goal. He said, let's examine a number of things that are all related to this concept and idea of wealth. Wealth is related to the total net cash coming in per week, month, or year. Most of us easily understand the idea of making a certain number of dollars per week or per year. In high circles, this is known as cash flow, meaning that there is a regular flow of cash each pay period. That's a real difficult thing, you know. In nowadays times, is you know, people got sporadic cash flow because things happen for them sporadically. You know, fortunately for growing up, back in the day, my parents they had a regular job. You know, they worked government employees. To my parents, you know, the government is the best place ever to work. That's their experience, you know, and I respect, you know, their opinion and their experience. But, I mean, they were government employees, and their thing was that was the best place to work. But they had regular cash flow. They could make a budget. They could make plans. They could project where they could be as long as they were alive based on their job, working for the government, and what they could do for us. And I'm not knocking that one iota, because without that, then I wouldn't be here today. You know. But each generation is supposed to improve and go beyond. But the bottom line was they had regular cash flow. For most of us, the source of this cash flow is our job, business or profession. Having a consistently high weekly or yearly inflow of cash is what most people mean by wealth. This constant flow of cash enables most of us to deal with the constant flow of bills, expenses that we generate in our daily lives. And we are fortunate enough to be able to pay all of our flowing bills with our flowing cash. We are surviving. If there's a good deal of surplus cash remaining after we pay all our bills, called disposable income, then we could be considered wealthy, at least by some of those who do not have this surplus of cash. See, the question is, what do you do with your disposable income? What do you do with your disposable income? Do you invest it? Do you party it up? Do you do other things with it? And, you know, he says, the key word in this statement above, however, is the word total. Wealthy people, you see, almost always have more than one form of income. The income could come from investments in stocks, real estate, or any of the thousand other resources. The key point, however, is to remind wealth is related to having one source of income. We will look into this point later on in this book. And so, you know, I want to leave you with that thought today as we talk about that in terms of this concept of wealth. And we're going to really, you know, dive into the book tomorrow. We might listen to a little bit more of the interview I did with George tomorrow, or I might say some for next week because we got a three-week period here to get through this. But we want to thank you for tuning in this morning as we, you know, reliving and reviewing the works of my good friend and colleague, comrade, struggle, Brother George Sevier, who transitioned December 10th, 2010, and he left a significant amount of information behind for us to follow through on. Hey, if you got any questions or comments or things you'd like to share, you can always send us a text, 252-406-0774. That's 252-406-0774. Hey, we want to thank you for tuning in to Home-Based Business 101 here this morning on Blog Talk Radio. God willing, the creek don't rise. We'll be back again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. as we continue reviewing the works of Brother George Sevier. And this week we're reviewing his book, Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America. Until next time, God bless you and have a wonderful day.